Welcome to the Law Shit You Should Know podcast. We're here to talk a little bit about the law
and a whole lot about nothing. Every week, we have a new guest to discuss current events, legal drama, and dive even deeper into
the Law Shit You Should Know. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Law Shit You Should Know with Alina Santana
and Leslie Marenko.
And today we have the amazing Dylan Gonzalez,
our illustrious guest.
Illustrious guest, yes.
How are you guys? I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
We're good, we're good. So tell our viewing and listening audience what you do, who you are.
So my name is Dylan Gonzalez. I'm a personal injury attorney down here in South Florida. Our office is here in Coral Gables. We operate throughout the state of Florida, and we specialize in trying cases. You know, we have a good combination of cases that we either will take from other attorneys that work in the personal injury space that don't want to try cases, that don't really want to heavily litigate. You know, we found that obviously you maximize your recovery and your settlement when you go to trial, when you litigate, and you put that type of pressure on the insurance companies. And then, you know, the other half of our practice is just organic stuff that kind of comes in, you know, just normal walk-ins. You know, friends, family, people find you on the internet and things of that nature when, you know, they get hurt. And that's primarily what we do. I've been a personal injury attorney at our practice now that we started about 6.5 years ago. It's me. I have 3 other law partners. And we've grown to about a staff of 20, 22 now. We just got done hiring a couple other attorneys recently. And, you know, it's been a long journey. You know, it's been a long journey.
And is that all you do in your office, personal injury?
So I do 95% of personal injury. I was a baseball player back in the day. I grew up born and raised here in South Florida, and so then I have a sports representation side of my practice too. Just, you know, that I dabble in. You know, it's really nice to kind of give back and just kind of...
Wait, so what does that actually mean? Because we might have many other personal injury attorneys on this podcast, but I don't think we've ever heard anything about sports agent.
So, basically, I played ball. I was born and raised here in Miami. I played baseball ever since I was like 4. And I was fortunate enough to be, you know, decent enough to play in college. I played professionally for a little bit. And I went to college out in California. I always wanted to kind of get away. And so I had opportunities to play here at Miami. I signed my letter of intent actually at University of Florida back in 2003. And when the opportunity presented itself for me to kind of get away, which is something I was really eager to do just growing up down here, I did. And I went to California, got drafted out of high school by the Giants, got drafted out of college by the St. Louis Cardinals, and then I went to go play for a few years. And at that point, once my career kind of came to an end, it was right around the time I went to law school. You know, I was ready to be done with baseball. I had opportunities to go work in the front office and do not necessarily like coaching stuff, although I could have. It was really more of, you know, say the track to become a general manager. But for me, to be honest, when baseball or hockey or basketball, whatever it is that you're pursuing is like such a big part of your life, I was ready for a change, you know. And I wanted to do something that mattered, do something that was, you know, more impactful for me, for my why, you know, my purpose for existing. And I became an attorney. And and so when that...
So are you one of those happy attorneys?
Yeah, I mean...
No, I'm still trying to get to how do you represent...
Which is where I'm getting to. So then, you know, once I had gotten enough space in between me and, say, baseball, you know, it was nice.
So this was purposeful. Like, the way you're describing it is very...
happy. It was a plan.
Okay, cute.
Yeah, exactly.
Just fall into it.
And so...
But you needed space between you and baseball to even, like, start...
Yeah, thinking about it again, you know? And for, like, you know, people...
It sounds like there's, like, pain or something here.
To be honest with you, I think that if you speak to a lot of guys that play baseball... really a lot of sports, and they play it seriously from a very young age. But I find it, for some reason, I don't know why, but with baseball more than any other sports, like, you'll see golfers, they kind of go and play golf after they get done playing, you know. You'll see tennis players that'll go and still hit. You know, you'll see hockey players that might even kind of go play, you know, afterwards. You don't really find a lot of baseball players that play, let's say, at the higher levels in college or professionally that will then go play in an adult league, like the NECA League and Tamiami. You know, and it happens from time to time, and everybody's different. But I know that a lot of my friends and a lot of people that I played with, like, when we were in the locker room, were like, listen, when we're done, we're fucking done. you know, and that's kind of how it was. And for me, I could never quit. I was really looking more for permission to move on from the game. And so when I got released from the Cardinals organization, although I had an opportunity to go play with some other teams, and I could go and play like in Colombia or in the Dominican or Mexico, whatever, you know, it was permission for me to kind of let go and then start focusing on something else, you know. And for me, that was the most important thing. Now, to answer your question, how I got into it is that once that space kind of went by, I had a good foundation with our personal injury practice. You know, being a sports agent is a very cutthroat and kind of miserable early years of existence, because you have people that are flip-flopping from one agent to the next in the locker room just based on, you know, who's got the nicest glove or nice shoes and things like that.
Fulanito got a better deal.
Yeah, correct. Exactly. And what a lot of players don't really understand and realize is that a lot of the guys in minor league ball, unless you were a top draft pick or a really big-time sign, you don't have that pedigree to go and demand, say, a deal from Nike or a deal from Rawlings. And so what's happening? You as the sports agent are actually fronting or investing in your player and actually paying for a discount because, you know, you have a relationship with Rawlings or Wilson or Louisville Slugger, whoever it is. You know, but this is an investment, you know. And so before you get into that space, it could be definitely not just a time suck, but a big money drain if you are choosing the wrong players. And then you have players that are literally just kind of leaving to the next, you know, flashy object in the room, you know. So for me, it's more of a passion thing that I enjoy doing, but it's not like necessity, you know. We pay our bills with our personal injury practice, and we've been fortunate enough to be really successful with it. And so, you know, I had a very good relationship with like a lot of the Latinos, you know, when I used to play. And I think that stemmed from my desire and my passion just for like geopolitics, international relations, and other stuff like that. So I was like searching for something different. And so when I was playing ball, I kind of, you know, nestled in with like the international crew, and so like, you know, my Spanish.
In the locker rooms,
you'd have like a good blend.
You'd
have a good blend between. I'd say it was like 60-70% of the dudes like be here from the States, and then you'd have like a good 30-40%, you know, be from the DR, Venezuela, Cuba, wherever. Mexico from time to time. It also depends on the organizations, because each organization might have like a different focus. You know, like some, like the Houston Astros, my dad actually happens to work with the organization and he's had a really great career. Couldn't be prouder of him. And he's actually known for actually signing a lot of Cuban players, you know. And Houston Astros has a very large Cuban population in their farm system. You know, other teams, you know, might have more of a focus in the DR, you know, others might have a focus with Venezuelans. Things these days are a little bit more difficult on the Venezuelan side, obviously just because the condition and state of the country, but you know, it's all different. So that's kind of how I ended up getting back to it. You know, I had been presented opportunities in the early days of our practice, from guys actually in the big leagues, and my dad would be looking at me, he's like, see, he's like, that guy just signed a fucking monster deal. He's like, you could have had him. And it was like,
thanks, Dad.
Yeah, I was like, thanks. Yeah, for sure. I mean, that gave you an idea of like what it would be like growing up with a father after a baseball game, which everybody knows that's like. It's like, oh, you should have fucking swung at that, or you should have been more aggressive here. You know, but it doesn't stop when you become a grown ass adult. I'm turning 39 next year, and I might as well be 9. So.
So when you say you represent them, are you representing them on the agent side or more legal side? Because you said it was part of your practice.
So, I mean, it's a part of my practice, a very small fraction of it. I mean, I only have a couple ball players right now, and they're the minor league system. And they, it's really more of kind of like you do it all a little bit for them, you know, because as a sports agent, you're not really just managing their contract. But you're also,
their lives.
Yeah, you really are. You know, whether it's like, hey, a player might have had a run-in with the law. What do they do?
I was just going to say, this is like, you better not be doing hookers and coke right now. We have a game tomorrow.
Yeah.
Whatever it is.
Yes.
Like, I feel like there's a huge financial planning aspect to this.
Yeah,
right? I always hear stories 100%, about how players get in trouble with these big contracts and they blow all the money and they have no concept of like,
you're
going to do this forever, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I had a player, you know, he had a couple different cars within the first year. I was like, dude, that's not the best, you know, way to spend your money, especially if you're going to be away playing ball for like 9 months and you're only going to see your car for like 2 months, you know. Other clients, you know, might have an issue with, because again, you know, they might not know the laws in the state of Florida. So do they have to have PIP? Do they not have PIP? Did their insurance agent put them in the right policy? Are they going to get their license suspended because they don't have PIP? It's good because I actually happen to have experience on that end because I'm a personal injury attorney as well. So that's helpful. But, you know, you're doing all sorts of stuff. And then also, you know, and I find this in my personal injury practice too, because when you are fortunate enough to be able to help people with their problems, they will then think of you for all of their problems. You know, so I'm a personal injury attorney, and, you know, we go out of our way to make sure that we provide proper customer service and good representation. But then, you know, you are able to kind of gain that trust. And then next thing I know, I had a client who was catastrophically injured, you know, multi-million-dollar settlement, and he calls me for a promissory note because he wanted to, like, you know, engage in some type of, like, business lending scheme with somebody else, you know. And things like that, you know. So yeah, you just kind of have to know a little bit of everything.
at least
on the baseball side. Yeah, exactly. Correct, right. Exactly.
I like that. Yeah, because so, I'm assuming you guys on the weekend aren't drafting promissory notes for...
This is correct. That would be a very, very bad use of our time. Yes,
it would. Yeah.
So you are primarily a personal injury.
Correct.
So let's talk a little bit more about that, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
I feel like this is a super hot topic in law right now, is personal injury. Everybody's talking about all the changes that are going on.
At least here in Florida.
Well, I was about to say, not really, right? I mean, yes, huge topic in Florida. A couple of our guests have mentioned it. I think it's been all over the news. Most people, I think, know there's something going on, even if they have no concept of what it really is. But, and I think most of our listeners and watchers know we're based in Florida at this point, just because of our guests. But there are...
If it wasn't obvious.
But it wasn't just... It's not just Florida, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so in prepping for the podcast, you sent me some stuff that had been going on in Iowa. So
correct,
tell us about that.
Yeah, so I think the way I'd probably want to frame that is that with respect to the lawsuit that happened in Iowa, it was really more of just to kind of provide people an insight of the lengths that insurance companies
will go. So wait, I don't know anything about anything in Iowa.
Yeah.
So
let's start from the beginning.
Okay.
So tell us what happened.
So basically, there's a famous trial attorney. He's out of California, I believe. His name is Nick Raleigh. And he is, you know, one of the juggernauts in this space. An incredible trial attorney. He's had incredible results. And frankly is somebody that, you know, I look forward to kind of just reading up on and reading a lot of the materials and stuff he puts out, because he's a really great trial attorney. And I think a great example of what trial attorneys should be aspiring to be like and what they should be doing. But basically he had a medical malpractice lawsuit that led to some brain defects for a young child that was born. The family ended up bringing a lawsuit against the small practice there in Iowa.
Female-owned OBGYN.
Correct.
Correct. Three women doctors.
Exactly. And
against what, their insurance carrier and everything
else?
Well,
it was a third-party situation, so the lawsuit from the family would be suing the practice itself. Obviously, you know, they would have their own liability carrier, at which point if they get a demand letter, they get some type of notice that they're going to be sued, they would notify their insurance carrier so they can do their due diligence and investigate whether or not they need to provide coverage and protect the OBGYN practice. Now, based on, I don't know all the facts on the case, but these are just the general points, is that they were in communication and negotiation talks with the OBGYN practice. And it appeared that both sides were interested in potentially resolving. Now, obviously, the OBGYN practice might be interested in resolving, but they then have to go up to the higher-ups at the insurance carrier to be like, hey, listen, we have this, and that. This might be favorable to us or might not be. These are our concerns. Should we settle? Should we not settle? Are you going to settle? Whatever the situation is.
Yeah, it seems like all the parties were ready to settle.
Correct.
Basically.
Right. And that appears to be what was going on. However, the insurance company did not settle. And so the question then becomes, why did they not settle? And
they said, no, take that shit to trial.
Well, their actions seemed to kind of put them in that direction, you know? So
okay.
it appeared, at least based on the information that I've read, you know, that's out in just, you know, the you know, internet and news articles and things of that nature, they were interested in settling within the policy limits that the OBGYN practice had. So could be $10 million, could be $50, could be $1. We don't know, but we know
whatever
that
it is, they were covered for.
Correct. We
yeah.
know that the plaintiff, the moving party, Nick Raleigh and his clients were interested in settling within the policy limits. And the insurance company did not tender the policy limits and actually forced this matter to go to trial, right?
Okay.
Now, what ends up happening in that situation is that you can go to trial and you ask the jury for an amount, right? You're not telling them that, hey, the policy limits were $1 million or $10 million. You ask them for what you believe the claim to be worth,
right.
And the jury will then end up providing what the claim is worth, what they believe the claim is worth. Now, in some instances, that verdict can be well in excess of the insurance policy, or it can be well below. There might be laws at play that cause or create an offset that then maybe bring it down within the policy limits.
Mm-hmm.
What we do know is that his verdict was somewhere over $90 million. It might have been 97.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
$7 million.
It was $97 million for the brain damage that was caused to the child.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it goes without saying, the business probably would not be able to survive that type of verdict, right? Because
they bankrupted the OBGYN's
right.
office.
Well, they filed bankruptcy, and they're
mm-hmm.
not doing things to try to insulate their need
mm-hmm.
to end up paying. Now, the thing that's interesting here, and this is the part that I don't think a lot of lay people know, and frankly a lot of other lawyers know, are the lengths that insurance companies are willing to go to change the law. Because maybe they pay a $100 million verdict here, right? But they might save tens of billions of dollars over the course of, you know, the next 10 years based on the laws that they were able to change by using this one example. And the reason I say that is that it's actually a little bit of personal experience from other things that we've done when we first started our practice, which we can get into. But a perfect example would be to think about the McDonald's case, you know. And you think about, like, just different talking points that people will have, you know, out in the public, you know, because it's very easy to incense lay people that are struggling with their daily lives, that are just trying to find, you know, happiness in what they're doing. You know, I deal with it. I'm sure you guys deal with it. Everybody is trying to find their purpose and what they're happy with. And when you hear a story about, like, oh, somebody just got, you know, $5 million, you know, for spilling coffee on their lap, what you don't think of is 180-degree, you know, liquid being spilt on your lap from a 70-year-old woman that then all of a sudden had, you know, third-degree burns and needed skin grafts, you know, because they don't leave that in the article or the commercial, or they don't show you the photographs of the skin, like, melting off of her body, you know,
okay,
as a result of that type of stuff.
The McDonald's case was publicized as, you know, one of the most frivolous
Correct.
Lawsuits ever, you know, in personal injury.
Correct.
I remember. It was
yeah.
a long time. It was in the 90s.
Like, yeah, for
thing.
Sure.
Yeah.
For sure. And so then,
I actually
like,
remember this.
Yeah.
I was a kid, and I remember this lawsuit.
Well, I don't even remember that until I actually got to law school, and that was something, you know, because I went to law school in 2010, and that's the first time I heard of it, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But it stood the test of time for people to still be talking about it.
Yeah.
You know, and so the reason I bring that up, though, is because obviously the insurance company, you know, the argument would be, if this is in fact true, but it would not surprise me, just given the things that we've experienced and the things that we've seen, is that they have a small, you know, female practice, you know, private practice, OBGYN practice in the state of Iowa. And now these poor doctors are going to have to now go out of business,
yeah.
you know, because of this crazy big lawsuit, you know. And it's only because these greedy personal injury attorneys are out there, you know, making these things happen. We need to change the laws and protect these people, you know, from these you know, incredibly greedy trial lawyers.
So what has happened in Iowa is that the insurance lobby is using this case
right.
as a way to try
so
to change
the counterpoint is
yeah.
now that the insurance lobby is saying, look what y'all did, all
yeah.
these personal injury attorneys suing everybody, and now, you know, these four, three female OBGYN small practice, we've destroyed their business,
right.
they've had to file for bankruptcy, they're leaving the state of Iowa, thus we need reform.
Right, and the thing that people would not necessarily know, right? All the lay people that are going to then go vote on these potential tort, you know, reforms in the state of Iowa, what they're not told is, hey, there's something called bad faith. There's something called, you know, where the insurance company has to look out for the interest of their insured, which was the OBGYN practice.
Right.
And at the time in which they knew what the facts were of this case, and they knew what the exposure of their insured would be, right? Because you have the insurance and all this money here to protect whatever judgments or whatever claims
right.
might exist. And so when they see that there's a child that will have this brain defect and might, you know, need, you know, $15 million for the rest of their life, and they only had a $20 million policy, the insurance company is supposed to put the interests of you or their insured above their own and not think about the money that they would save. And they should be chasing down that person to basically hand them a check for $15 million if it's going to end up settling for something around that money, right? And if they don't, And you then, as the injured party, have to go hire an attorney who then needs to take a fee, right? Because obviously the insurance company was not going to do the right thing until you got involved. Well, then now that person that is you're the injured party, right, say the family there, is then going to be without funds because they have to hire an attorney. And that attorney is not free. He's going to have to take a percentage of that. And so that money that otherwise could have been dedicated towards, you know, life care planning and everything else is now going to have to be shared with the attorney so they can go and teach a lesson to the insurance company and get your recovery. But then the law provides something, you know, under the bad faith laws, which basically says if the insurance company appears to be putting their interests ahead of their insured, that there is no limit, in essence, to what that policy said. So, like, you might have had only $1 million policy.
Oh, interesting.
But if the insurance company put you in a position to where you might be liable for $20 million, you know, because that's what the jury said the verdict was worth, well, then that insurance company, you know, would potentially be on the hook for that.
Because they are the ones that refused to settle.
Correct. And the insured was perhaps interested and willing to do so. Because if there was no bad faith, right, what would actually happen in a lot of those situations, so let's talk about here in the state of Florida, because I'm not an attorney in any other state, and I want to make sure that I'm not getting in any trouble.
No, yeah.
But here in the state of Florida, for example, you have and this is a case actually I just dealt with, you know, somewhat recent, and I have to keep it, you know, pretty ambiguous because it was a confidential settlement, but
sure.
It was a young kid in his early 20s had a terrible slip and fall accident that resulted in a fractured spine. He's going to be in a wheelchair for the rest of his life. Beautiful, beautiful family, beautiful kid. I couldn't have been, you know, more privileged to have, you know, him come to us to represent him and just kind of guide him throughout that process. And that was, by the way, the reason why I stopped playing ball was like for moments like that, you know, where you can actually really impact real change. And anyways, in his situation, the insurance company did not tender the policy, which happened to only be $1 million, right? And so you have a young kid in his 20s that is now a quadriplegic, which by everybody's, you know, I'd say experience, even as a non-lawyer, you know it's a $50 million case or more. You know what I mean? Like, your life has been changed forever.
Yeah, it's tragic.
Yeah. You can't, I mean, you just where do you start in terms of how it is that your life has been impacted, right? And so
they didn't tender?
They did not tender the million-dollar policy, correct.
$1 million.
$1 million, correct. And so in that situation, they even had, and this was the analysis, at least at the time, they had been provided a release that allowed the insurance company to get medical records. They had been provided the opportunity to investigate the claim and see what was going on, even though information had been provided to them, and they still did not do anything. We were approached about 2.5-3 months after the actual incident, to then say, hey, you know, Dylan, what's going on? What can we do? Is there anything that I might have? I have hundreds of thousands of dollars in medical bills. You know, my life has obviously been changed. We don't know what's going to happen next. And at that point, I put together a demand letter, you know, with all the necessary photographs, you know, depicting what it is that actually occurred, advising the insurance company what happened, telling them where it happened, and all the other circumstances that were involved, attaching medical records that showed the condition. And again, it said he was a kid in his early 20s, was a quadriplegic, which you would think is all you need to know. And at that point, they asked for more information, which was a blessing and a curse at the same time. You know, it's sad, right, that the insurance company is still trying to, like, withhold these funds from somebody that would obviously need them. But because, thankfully, of the laws that we have here in the state of Florida, we were able to make sure that we quadrupled, you know, or roughly quadrupled that policy amount so that he could actually have more funds to kind of take care of himself and his future, you know. Now,
I was about to say, that's still true under all the...
So is it the injured party that says this is bad faith, or the insured that says, fuck you, insurance, I've been paying you all this time,
exactly.
And now you don't even want to tender a fucking measly $1 million keeping me in this goddamn lawsuit?
Exactly, and that's actually the point of the story, is to kind of talk about, like, so in this situation, if there was no bad faith, right, and you end up suing the business that was responsible for his injuries, and let's say there was only $1 million in coverage, and you go to trial, and you end up getting a $30 million verdict, okay? The insurance company, if they tried to tender, and then you say you did have a greedy personal injury attorney and said, hey, I wanted to go and just get a really big verdict and see if I can hit the insurance company for bad faith. Well, it's not guaranteed that just because you get a $30 million verdict, that you're going to have that coverage from the insurance company to cover it. And frankly, most businesses would not have those types of funds unless you're suing like a Johnson & Johnson or a FedEx or something like that. And so what would end up happening is you would then, after you get the $1 million from the insurance company, after you got, say, a $30 million verdict, and then you would have to turn your attention to the business owner and say, okay, let's, you know, pay up. You know, you got to pay my client for the terrible damages that you caused my client, right? Now, in that situation, the guy is either going to go, or the woman is going to go bankrupt, right? Or they're going to pay up, or they're going to ask for a payment plan, or maybe they would try to settle with something else. Maybe you don't get a $30 million verdict. Maybe you can only get, you know, $800,000 more dollars or whatever the situation is, because you just know that you can't get blood from a stone, you know?
Yeah.
Now, that's in a situation where there's no bad faith, right? Because the insurance company did what they needed to do. They wanted to pay the $1 million, but the insurance, the attorney and the injured party did not take it. They went to trial. And now they have to look for their recovery, not from the insurance company, because they were only insured to provide up to $1 million. And then they have to look to the business that caused the harm for the rest.
Mm-hmm.
But in a situation where you have a bad faith context, where the insurance company had an opportunity to settle for their insured to protect the business so they did not go out of business, because they knew that the reason that they had this insurance is because they were trying to prevent
so that they don't have to go bankrupt.
Correct, go bankrupt or use their personal funds from their bank account or whatever the situation is. And so the insurance company has a duty to put the interests of their insured above their own and do what a reasonable insurance company would do given what the facts and the circumstances are at the time. And so in this situation, like I said, the good and the bad of it was that the bad is that the insurance company is doing what insurance companies do a lot of the times. They put their interests over their own. They're a publicly traded company. They care about investors. They care about money. It's a whole, you know, different conversation. So they just held on to it and continue to make the personal injury attorney work and withhold those funds. The good thing was is that every reasonable, objective adjuster would know if you had a young man in his early 20s that just was paralyzed as a result of your insured.
Yeah,
it's not a $1 million case. It's a $50 million case or more. Now, the thing that was even more, that was crazier about it, and this is the sad truth, is that in the state of Florida, there's something called comparative negligence, which did just kind of get modified and changed a little bit
in
March of 2023. But in this situation, the reason why it was even more obvious that it was a bad faith situation is that, you know, our client was engaging. He wasn't necessarily completely, you know, not blameless, but I would just say, like, there was a certain portion of the behavior that was being engaged in that may have been avoidable, right? And so in the state of Florida, under the old negligence theory, which was pure comparative negligence, basically said that the jury can apportion the amount of fault to the tortfeasor, the person that causes the harm, and then obviously, you know, apportion the rest to the plaintiff, the moving party, if they believe that he was partially responsible for his own injuries. So you can think about a rear-end accident would be a good situation where, generally speaking, the person directly behind you is going to be 100% at fault. That's the reason why the presumption exists, because, you know, you're seeing what's happening in front of you. You should have slowed down, been traveling with enough distance in between the two vehicles. But if, say, you go between a car intersection, and let's say it was a yellow light or it was a red light, you know, or you had the green light, you know, and you're going through a green light. You're going through a green light, and you see another vehicle coming from, let's say, you know, 500 yards away, and it's speeding. And the facts come out at trial that you could have taken evasive action to avoid it. Slow down. Yeah, you had the green light, but what are you going to do? You're going to barrel down the intersection even though you have the green light, and
like,
then T-bone the other
like
car?
Hit me, fucker.
Right.
Only in Miami.
I mean,
I'm not going to lie. I've had moments in traffic where I'm like, come at me, bro.
Not only that. I mean, obviously, that's the different conversation is that, you know, maybe there are people, sadly, that do need to be regulated because maybe there are staged accidents from time to time, you know?
That's a whole different conversation.
Correct.
I am a lawyer after all.
I represent a lot of people who have gotten themselves in some fraudulent accidents and got involved in immigration.
Allegedly fraudulent accident, because I don't admit it.
Start with the immigration process.
So, you know, as it relates to, you know, the car accidents and say a T-bone intersection, or a T-bone accident in an intersection, you're going through and say you see somebody, even though you have the green light coming and you could have avoided the accident, And let's say the jury ends up putting 85%, you know, or 90% on the party that ran the red light.
Mostly their fault, but a little bit your fault.
They put 10% on you because, you know, hey, you could have done something. You should have been paying attention. Maybe you were on the phone too. And so even though you had the green light, if you were on the phone, you weren't talking, you weren't distracted. So you're going to get some, you know. So in our situation, though, as it related to the slip and fall, where my client was, you know, paralyzed, I told the insurance company, and this was something that was made very clear in the demand letter, is like, you know, guys, listen, even if you want to take the position that our client had a certain percentage of blame in this particular incident, you're talking about a $50 million, you know, injury. You're talking about 40 tens of millions of dollars. We know one thing. It's definitely in excess of $1 million policy. And so even if it's in excess of $1 million policy, and let's say you just put 90% of the fault on my client, right, and 10% on your insured, that still leaves
you. You still got to pay.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
And you have to pay not just like a little bit, but you have to pay over your policy of $1 million because, right, you know, 10% fault of a $45 million verdict is a $4.5 million, you know, mm-hmm, verdict, right? And that's what I explained to them. And we mock tried it. We did focus groups. We did, you know, we did this right. We filed the lawsuit because they did not respond. They never even sent us the letter saying what the insurance policy was. So throughout this entire process, I still, as the lawyer, did not even know if there was coverage in this particular case. Yeah.
What pajarito insurance company was this? Yeah, I mean, so is this like Adoro?
Can't tell you.
Yeah. Is this State Farm? Like,
Estrella.
Is this a legit insurance company?
Listen.
Can you at least say? I mean, is this like...
So
Jose Pablito Insurance.
It was definitely a confidential settlement, so I can say. But what I could, what I,
not tell
yeah,
you.
But what I could say is that it actually was a very reputable and very legit insurance company.
And something
that you would not have expected, you know, from someone
worse.
It's the gecko.
No, I'm kidding.
Which then again, you know, goes again just to kind of magnify and show you that, you know, these insurance companies, a lot of the time what they do is a little more calculated and nefarious than I think people kind of lead on. Because in the situation in Iowa, what's happening is they see this. And you ask yourself, okay, well, why are they not going to then just protect this OBGYN all-female practice and empower this practice to continue to thrive and succeed? Well, because maybe as they are doing some type of side deal and telling the OBGYN practice, and this is all theoretical because I have no idea and don't know anything about the facts of the case, you know, but let's say, assume for a second, hey, guys, we got you. We'll protect you. We'll make sure that you guys are set up. We'll pay for all this other type of stuff. We'll assist you in maybe some type of other, like, you know, side deal and make sure that you guys don't die and continue practice, you know, medicine or whatever. But let this case ride. We're going to use the results to kind of help change tort reform because, you know, at the end of the day, it's just ridiculous that, you know, someone would have to pay $97 million for this type of situation, right?
You know, you say that, and I know you say you don't know the facts and blah, blah, blah. I can tell you, I went down the Google black hole with this case, and I was reading, and yes, of course I did. You know, this is what I do.
What?
And I'm not nearly as afraid. He works in this industry. I don't. So
she's nearly as afraid to talk shit right now about what's going to happen.
Yeah. I read that there were text messages showing what they had.
There's actual...
There's actual documentation that this...
Of
course. That they were essentially, this is the case, the test case, and we're going to convince all these legislators to pass them some sort of reform.
Well, I was going to say, in the OBGYN,
or doctors who you've bankrupted,
like, if I'm the OBGYN and this shit goes south,
yeah,
you motherfuckers are the free sprinkle. I'm like going to sue, right?
Yeah.
Like my own insurance.
And that's where the bad faith kind of component comes into it, right? Because you generally, as you're going through this process, it's a long process. It might take a couple of years to kind of get to trial. Throughout that time, and as an OBGYN, you know, business owner, you're going to see your house burning around you, and you might be telling your insurance company, "Hey guys, settle the case. What's happening? Whatever."
Yeah.
And if they don't do that, you also know, and you're likely going to get, you know, counsel from your either personal counsel or from the attorney representing you on the case. And be like, these are the other things that you have available to you, because if your insurance company is not taking care of you, you may have bad faith, you know, and bad faith action against your carrier. Now, what ends up happening is technically the OBGYN practice would have the bad faith case against the insurance
company.
Their
own carrier.
But what they would do is they would assign the rights. And again, I have no idea how things work in Iowa,
yeah,
but this is generally how things would be. They would assign the rights to the party that just obtained the $97 million judgment so that they can then sue the insurance company.
Oh, Jesus.
And then, you know... Nick Raleigh can go have some fun and basically, you know, make an example of what's going on. Because if you're in the article, you know, they asked him, he's like, you know, are you concerned? He's like, yeah, it's going to be a difficult case to prove. He's like, yeah, not really. He's like,
it's not, there are text messages.
Yeah, he's like, I'm not too concerned. He's like, because we're going to get everything. We're going to get the emails. We're going to get the text messages.
Yeah. Oh,
we're
going to
get all of these things. And you know what? Good for him. And I hope he does. Because the other side of this is that insurance companies are emboldened a lot of the time because not all attorneys will go the extra distance. You know, in fact, a lot of them will not. You know, a lot of them won't try cases. A lot of them won't litigate because it's a lot of work. You know, and the sad truth is that across all walks of life, across all industries, people a lot of the time take the least restrictive means. You know, they don't really want to be fighting too much and fighting too hard. And
well, you got to front the cost of this shit show for 3 years or 4 years or whatever it is, right?
So, not to mention the stress, right? I mean, I feel like we don't talk about that enough.
The mental health side.
Yeah, there is a huge. I mean, getting sued is. I've been around lots of people who have been sued just civilly in their businesses, and it's stressful and for years. It's not like 3 months.
Yeah.
It's years and years of stress of what the fuck's going to happen and where am I going to be a year from now? And it's
but to the insurance company, it's like a line item on their fucking books. You know,
I don't give a shit. I'm talking about the actual individuals involved on both sides, frankly.
Yeah, no, I mean, listen, the defense. I mean, look, there's a reason why, and you know, on the mental health side, I mean, why suicide is actually as prevalent as it is, you know, in the legal practice, and why that does take place. And it's because it's very demanding and it's very difficult. You're away from your family. You might be questioning what you've been doing for the last 10, 15 years and where the time has gone. And it is something that the defense attorneys who are representing the insurance companies will suffer and deal with just as much as, say, a personal injury attorney or a criminal defense attorney or a trust attorney or immigration.
Secondary post-traumatic stress syndrome, like secondary PTSS.
Right. And with all that stuff being said, insurance companies know and understand that personal injury attorneys or attorneys in general, litigating attorneys, don't always want to push and create that pressure because it's a lot of work.
Yes.
And so they know, and there was actually a study done back in the 70s or 80s where insurance companies basically realized that they can withhold settlement on all of these cases and they won't get sued all the time. You know, and they know that a certain percentage of them are going to settle another portion of the time, you know, and because there's a small percentage of them that will make it to litigation, that will actually make it to the door and go to trial, and so that they will end up making more money by withholding actual settlements, by keeping it in a T-bill, by keeping it in the stock market, by putting it in some other avenue of investment to basically be accumulating this wealth while they are then going to pay a settlement, let's say a year and a half down the road, with the interest that they just got them making on whatever the principal was.
Yeah.
You know, so like that's the thinking, and that's the thing that people don't really think about all the time. I mean, and this is, it's really like the trend that Florida is kind of like embarking on and the direction that we're going is, yes, it is true that there are fraudulent claims. It is true that insurance companies can get taken advantage of, you know, and they do in some instances, and that needs to be protected. But it's also true that there's currently mechanisms in place, you know, that actually prevent and deter that type of behavior without there being a massive tort reform project, you know, without the governor having to go and actually give a handout to insurance companies in these spaces. And if you want to look at no other example, and it doesn't even affect me in my personal injury space, it's in the property damage space.
Oh, my God.
You know? And
oh, yeah.
There was there was fraud taking place, you know, in that space, but there are also a lot of legitimate claims in that space. And one way you can deter against fraud is you can file 57-105s. You can file proposals for settlement, which are things that would actually put the injured party, say the insured in that situation, the homeowner, potentially on the hook for the hundreds of thousands of dollars that would be at play in that lawsuit if the defense attorney won and the insurance company prevailed in that lawsuit. But what you also need, if you're going to file a 57-105, is you need judges to actually be willing participants in the process and not be afraid to sanction attorneys or sanction, say, the moving party if it is warranted. And sadly, in a lot of instances, at least at the state level, state judges are elected, you know, and so they're more concerned, sadly, about punishing the moving party or the bad behavior that's taking place, which then may create a reason or a need for laws to be changed in a way that's going to hurt the consumer. And so if you have a situation, let's say I'm a homeowner, I don't know if you guys, you know, own any property,
yep.
But one thing is clear is that for decades in the state of Florida, if an insurance company did not pay out the money that was recently owed to the homeowner, and that insured had to bring a lawsuit against their insurance company for $5,000, for $50,000, for $500,000, whatever the damages were, and they prevailed, the insurance company would be responsible for paying the attorney's fees. That existed for a reason, an important reason. And that was because if you had a $5,000 damage, you know, to your windows or to your roof, and attorneys, sadly, get paid, you know, well, not sadly, but it's just like that's the way it is, you know. And we as attorneys should not be backing down for the fact that we command and earn a lot of money either, you know, because that's the reason why we went to school and gave up a lot just to kind of go through that process, right? But at the same time, it's not cheap, but it's more expensive to bring a lawsuit that might be only worth $10,000 to the insurance company. And so what the law is trying to do is trying to create an incentive for the consumers to be protected and also to incentivize the insurance companies to pay for a $10,000 recovery or $5,000 recovery. And the only way they can do that is by making sure that that homeowner is covered and going to get back everything that they owe for that $10,000 damage. And the insurance company is going to have to pay the $50,000 attorney bill at the end of that litigation. Now, what just happened as a result of Governor DeSantis changing the law is that no homeowner can ever be made whole.
Yep.
You can have, literally, you can be paying tens of thousands of dollars for 10 years to your insurance company. They're making money hand over fist. You then want to make a claim for $12,000 for windows that happened at your property because of the storm that came through. They can tell you, fuck you very much. You're then going to go to an attorney and say, hey, here's a $10,000, you know, claim that we have here. And the attorney's going to look at you and be like, hey, I'd love to help you. But, you know, I'm going to be spending well more than $10,000,
right.
Not just in my resources, but also in the cost to push this case forward. So I'm not going to be able to help you.
Yeah.
Unless,
I mean, even and $10,000 is
yeah.
a small claim. Like,
right.
to your point, the small claims are
yeah.
going to get fucked. I mean,
yeah.
that's really what it comes down to. But even slightly bigger than that, like, we had a property loss at our house. We had a flood.
Yeah.
Give or take about a $40,000 to $45,000
yeah.
loss overall. It was a pain in the ass to
yeah.
get the insurance company to offer
oh,
anything even close to that.
100%.
And they were, like, evaluating. I think I said this on one of our other episodes. Like, they were evaluating the walls where, like, drywall costs 4 cents. And I'm
yeah.
like, really? Where is this magical drywall?
No, 100%.
This magical
yeah.
Home Depot where everything
100%.
Is pennies on
where
the dollar.
Is
But think about this though too. Like, that's just like, say the people that are on the lower end of the damages
yeah.
side, or like $10,000 claim, a $5,000 claim. You're gonna have a $500,000, you know, claim, right?
Yeah.
You might have a multi-million-dollar home that you might say live in, and you have a $250,000 roof that needs to be replaced. Okay. Great. I guess the attorney that's going to move forward on that claim, yeah, he's going to get 30 or 40% of that potential recovery, and that's going to be able to kind of pay for his time that it took to litigate that case for 2 years. But what is the homeowner going to do after
right.
he gets
it
that money?
The
They're
going to
build
pocket.
A fucking 70% roof?
Right.
Hey, I
exactly.
put a roof on this
yeah.
side of my house, but this fucking side is completely open. So when Hurricane Lucy comes by, yeah. exactly.
From the magic
yeah.
Home Depot.
So it's just, it can't be beyond... unfair, you know, what it is that happened in terms of the handout that was just basically given to the insurance companies.
But it wasn't just
regard.
Property now.
Correct.
I kind of want to come back to personal injury.
Yeah.
Some really interesting cases. So I knew someone who used to handle a lot of personal injury cases related to negligence on commercial property.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, if someone had, like, a 7-Eleven
mm-hmm.
and late at night, someone
oh, like
got
security.
Shot in
negligent.
The parking lot.
Yeah.
That's the negligent security cases,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
There's big, big changes now with how those are handled,
yeah.
too, right?
Yeah.
Not talking about money, but I'm talking about who's at fault and
yeah,
how
correct.
They determine that. Can
yeah.
you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so in the premises liability context, it's really very similar to even a slip and fall case. You know, there's a danger that existed that you knew or should have known was there, and you had a duty to protect your consumer, the patrons that are coming onto your property.
Right. So in my example, the 7-Eleven has, let's say, a dark parking lot.
Correct.
You know there's been multiple robberies there.
Shootings.
You don't have any cameras
yeah.
for
security,
no security.
Yeah.
guard, et cetera, et cetera. And lo and behold, someone gets shot in your parking lot.
Exactly.
Yeah. Alina really loves to get Slurpees, like, at midnight.
Yes.
So,
oh,
you know, 7-Eleven,
we were
parking
definitely
lot.
At 7-Eleven last night getting Slurpees.
Okay.
But that was not my idea.
What flavor, though?
That
was it Coke? Yes.
Of course, the Coke.
Yes, I used to go with my aunt all the time when I was a kid.
I mean, you know.
Yeah. It's the old habits.
I think she's asking for it. I think she's definitely trolling 7-Eleven parking lot.
So the question is, if I get shot in the 7-Eleven parking lot?
Which I hope does not happen. I mean,
knock
on wood.
Where's
this? Yes. Yeah, here, right here. But yes, obviously that is a case that we will be able to do and help you with. But yeah, in a situation like that, they're profiting off of the public, you know. So the business and the reason why the law exists the way it does is that it's trying to protect those people that are actually giving their hard-earned money to those businesses and incentivize the businesses to protect the people that are keeping them afloat, right? And so if they know that at their particular location in their particular part of town, there's a high rate of violence, you know, robberies, burglaries, shootings, murders, whatever the situation is. And there were instances that happened within a half mile, a mile of that particular location, you know, or even at that location before it even happened. And they didn't have security guard. They didn't have any, like, signs, like, hey, don't... I mean, that's the reason why, by the way.
Don't come here at midnight to get...
Well, you'll see signs like...
I mean, I totally get it, right? Like, as a business owner, if in my parking lot, there's been people mugged at gunpoint multiple times, at some point, you're like,
and interesting,
oh, shit,
I think of the parking lot,
camera,
but you're saying you could
guard,
even
you know?
Use evidence of stuff happening half a mile away.
Yeah, for sure. Because, I mean, it's...
Next door.
Yeah, you have to make sure that this... That your community is aware that this is a very dangerous part of town if it's something that may impact them.
So if I'm a 7-Eleven, I'm just not opening a 7-Eleven in the ghetto. Like, this is just not happening.
No,
like,
no, you know, you are. But
he's
if you, but
he's like, you
know,
are, but
no, no, protection.
But you're because you want to make sure you're protecting the people that live in that community too. Because if you're going to go ahead and basically, because what you will also see, if you've ever seen The Wire, have you seen The Wire?
No.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So in The Wire, you'd
Law
see
Law and Order. No.
No. Wire.
That wholesome shit.
Yeah, you'll see, let's say you watch an episode of The Wire and you'll see that gas station, 7-Eleven or wherever, and you see hand-to-hands and prostitutes and things like that in just broad daylight, right? In a lot of parts of Miami, New York, LA, that stuff is going down.
Sure.
I mean, when I was a young public defender, and I actually had a case after at a very place that I was defending somebody that had been arrested at this location. And you go in there, broad daylight, you're just seeing hands-to-hands, you'll see like literally drug wrappers and stuff like that on the ground. And what's happening? That business is still operating, right? They're not putting security in place. They know that the drug dealers are using their place to basically sell to the public. Now, what's going to happen when a drug deal goes wrong and then one of your fucking patrons gets shot and killed? And
or
then,
your employees.
Yeah, correct. Like, exactly. All of those things.
Don't
open
a 7-Eleven in the ghetto.
Or if you are going to own a 7-Eleven about a part of town, just put in the necessary security precautions to make sure your people are protected.
And what does that look like?
A security guard. Lights.
Guard, cameras.
You know, bulletproof.
I'm like, this is a whole other part of your law firm,
glass.
Like consulting on
when
how to not get
those Slurpees at midnight. There's like a little window sometimes they slide over after a certain hour and you have to do, like at gas stations, you have to do all transactions through the little plastic.
Or have you
and
seen
how
does
that
to
have people
lottery
getting shot
morning?
Up in the parking lot?
That
no, well, if you see, have you seen the signs where it says like, do not leave valuables in plain sight or in the car. Like that's all about creating notice, you know, for the people that are coming in.
Yeah, don't be stupid.
Yeah. But I guess to just bring it full circle, so that's kind of like the, no, it's okay, but that's a part of the example of, say, what a negligent security case might look like, is the business owner is not putting precautions in place to protect his patrons, something happens, and then you as the patron that's injured can sue that property owner or the business that was operating there. Now, historically, the focus, and this is correct and where it should have been, when you're bringing the lawsuit and the action against, say, you know, any business, you know, where this is happening, a Tom Thumb, a 7-Eleven, whatever, and these are just examples, you would sue them and they would not be able to then, say, show that the defendant, say, the person that, say, murdered the person on that property was responsible, right? Because what that's doing is it's deflecting the focus of the civil process from one that's civil to one that's criminal, right? This was never about, was this person responsible for shooting this other person? No, it's not about that. That person 100% was responsible for shooting and killing somebody or injuring them on your property. The difference is did that business owner know or should they have known that that was likely to happen? And did they take precautions that could have prevented it, right? And so before the law change in March of 2023, you would not be able to put the name of that defendant, that criminally accused, who's now looking at a life sentence on the jury verdict form, and say, you know, to the jury, jury, who are you blaming? You know, and how much of that blame are you putting on the person that did the shooting? And how much are you putting it on the 7-Eleven, the Tom Thumb,
or the business?
Right,
because, I mean, it seems obvious that most juries will say, oh, the guy who did the shooting.
Right, because, yeah, because not everybody, you know, is a lawyer or has that legal education.
So are you just allowed to name them? Are you allowed to talk about them? Are they allowed to talk about them in the trial?
The defense, in essence, really is what's going to end up happening now, is that the defense is going to be able to list the name of the person that was accused or arrested, and they are going to basically kind of put on a separate case, in essence, right?
Right.
I'm going to be trying to prove, say, hey, this business is responsible for creating this dangerous condition and not giving any necessary warning or notice to the patrons as they're coming onto the property, and that's why John Smith, you know, coffee company is responsible for this shooting that occurred on their property. The attorneys on the defense are just like, John Smith, you know, isn't responsible.
Are you allowed to mention them over and over again in the trial?
Well, yeah, so what you're going
to
do is...
As attorney to the defense?
Yeah, you're going to be able to talk about and show... You know, I mean, this is obviously all as being... rolled out, obviously, this year.
Yeah.
We're in 2023 still, and so there's going to be a lot of trial and error in terms of what is and what is not permitted. You know, but the one thing, and the primary thing, is like by just having the name of the person that the defendant is now saying is responsible for this is going to provide a good amount of confusion to the jury.
Sure.
And frankly, it's devastating to the practice of negligent security, you know, law. And it's sad and it's unfortunate because... There's a reason why the rules of evidence and the rules of civil procedure have existed for hundreds of years, and the rules of evidence, it's been tried and true, and they've been developed and honed for a reason. And they're there to protect the public that don't have that legal training to understand what should and what shouldn't come into evidence that's not going to unfairly prejudice the jury, that's going to then affect their substantive rights, you know?
But that's just the verdict form. So my question is, can I call him as a witness? Like, can I put...
Monica, or Carlos, and be like, so Monica, why did you do that? Now that you're sitting in jail for 30 years, tell us.
Yeah, there's good luck getting somebody that's being accused criminally for and facing, you know, potentially a life sentence
to
come in and be like, hey guys, it was me, you know. That's not going to happen. I mean, what would potentially happen is,
from the defense side, like, so why'd you pick this location?
Yeah.
Oh, because it's dark, because there's no security.
Well, no.
The defense of putting them on, they're going to say the opposite.
Well, they're not going to say much of anything.
Right.
What they're going to say is, they're going to invoke my rights. They're not going to end up saying anything.
And
by the way, how great does it look when you invoke the rights in front of a jury anyways?
Then you look really
guilty. You know what I mean?
And so it's
a very sad situation because we had a case. Where our client was actually shot 6 times. In Liberty City, going to a neighborhood store at night, could walk to it. Great dude, great family. He was actually a train conductor here in South Florida and for the Tri-Rail system. And he was in a coma for 10 days. And he had hundreds of thousands of dollars in medical bills. And in that particular situation, there was a rivalry between some drug dealers and stuff like that. And he got caught in the crossfire. And he was one of three other people that got shot. And in that situation, there were a lot of other factors at play in that particular case on the coverage side. But the one thing that is clear is that it would have been a very different situation if we would have had to have gone and proven the case, you know, against the liquor store, or not the liquor store, but the convenience store, and saying that they were responsible because there had been a murder that took place there literally a month and a half before. Or all the robberies and drug deals that happened in broad daylight, you know, because that actually was the store that I had been to as a young public defender and seen what took place there. I actually had a friend of mine that was a public defender that actually was representing somebody that was being accused of homicide at that particular location in the months prior to my situation. So it was no surprise that it was dangerous. But if the defense in that situation was then allowed to put in the name of the drug dealer, you know, or whoever was accused, my client would not have been able to get a 7-figure, you know, resolution in that case.
Sure.
Or he may have, but he also very likely might not have, because a jury would have said, why are we going to blame the small fucking business for this when that piece of shit is out here murdering people? you know, they shouldn't be, you know, at fault. And what that's doing is it's really inflaming their passions, and by focusing on the very obvious fact of what this person did was wrong, but really completely ignoring the preventable measures that the business could have taken,
makes sense,
you know,
yeah,
to prevent this from taking place. So,
yeah. And that's just one of the changes that have happened with the
yeah.
reform in
yeah.
Florida, right?
Yeah.
Some other things like lowering the statute of limitations,
right,
which just makes it harder for people to get their shit together. You got to get your shit together faster, get everything filed. Wasn't there like a mass filing situation
yeah.
that happened?
Yeah.
I remember this in the news down here where it was like, I don't remember if it was hundreds of thousands or just thousands of cases that were
yeah.
mass filed to get in before
yeah.
the statute changed.
Yeah, I mean,
or,
yeah, we're not a big massive volume practice.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know, we don't have cases like a Rubenstein or a
right,
Morgan
right.
and Morgan and stuff. You know, we're more boutique.
I think it was Morgan and Morgan that came out with their statistics.
Oh yeah, for
publicly.
Sure.
That
yeah,
was nuts. 100%.
But they were doing it, you know, because there was a real need for it. They weren't doing it for any other reason other than, you know, the environment that existed that was created by not just the insurance companies, but by the governor in the state of Florida, Governor DeSantis. You know, he pushed this through.
Mm-hmm.
And so not only are there going to be challenges saying that it's not retroactive, and there's a decent case with it, but the reality is that there's going to be very... attorneys did not want to take the chances, rightfully and justifiably so,
mm-hmm.
that they would be able to be successful in appeal when the Florida Supreme Court has been, you know, potentially, you know, I don't know, benched by Governor DeSantis and,
sure.
and want to take the chances that with the very judges that have been put on the bench by him are then going to somehow find against Governor DeSantis when this was the law that he just basically put into effect. So that's one thing that people did not want to take, you know, a chance on. And there is, you know, some good legal arguments to make. And frankly, if the jurists there are analyzing the law, the plaintiffs on that side should come out victorious and it should not be retroactive. But at the end of the day, you would have to, number one, go through years of appellate work just to kind of make that happen.
No, this is retroactive to, like, the incident date?
Correct, yeah. Because basically what was happening is in the law, it would basically say that, you know, anything that was filed after this date
mm-hmm.
will be under the new law. Anything
got
that was filed before this date will be under the old law. And so it basically created a bookend for every personal injury practice in the state of Florida to say, hey, listen, if we're representing our clients in their best interest and to make sure that they're maximizing their recovery for their injuries and how they've been harmed, we need to make sure that all of these lawsuits are filed before, okay?
Right.
And so what
and
ended up happening is,
the
yeah, there was a race to the courthouse. Tens of thousands of lawsuits have been
go.
Filed, literally in like a week-long period. You know, at our law firm alone, we filed, I think, 65 lawsuits in a two-day period, you know? And the sad truth is that, you know, and this is going to hurt the consumers again, right? Because we already established that insurance companies know that not all personal injury attorneys try cases. They don't all go to court. They don't all litigate. And as a result, they now know that because not all attorneys are doing this, and really to maximize those recoveries, unless you're one of those attorneys that do that, you're not going to be bringing those lawsuits anymore, right?
Right?
Unless you're giving those cases to attorneys like us that actually try cases and litigate them, you know. But that was pretty terrible. And the other thing that it's doing is it's allowing those insurance companies and the defense attorneys to go to the insurance companies and say, excuse me, not the insurance companies, but go to the legislature and say, hey, do you see this ridiculousness? 30,000 lawsuits in a week? This is going to put the defense bar like out of work, or they're going to like people, there's going to be a mental health problem. You got to do something to control this. And this was all onset by the insurance company lobbying the governor to
right.
say that this is
sure.
all taking place and then showing the environment so that they can then go and start what they're trying to do, which is really try to perform more tort reform in the state of Florida. And this is just the beginning of what they're trying to do, you know?
In response to that, I want to talk specifically about Florida statistics for a moment. Mm-hmm. So in prepping for this podcast today, you sent me some really interesting articles, and I actually wrote down some of these numbers because I had to ask you about it. And the article you sent me said that Florida leads the way with, I think I wrote that down, well, no, with 1,237% more filings than the national average.
Right.
Is that accurate?
Crazy to
That's
me.
Fantastic.
And it said that per 100,000 people, Florida had 127.41 cases in court. 127.41 compared to the national rate of 9.53.
Right.
That is outrageous. So I gotta ask you, why?
Well, is that per population?
Yeah,
per
like
area?
Per
like, well, how
well,
are these statistics
that,
being?
If I'm
there are lies and there
are
statistics, right?
So. Yeah, well, if we're talking about the same article, I believe that article was talking about 2023 and talking
mm-hmm.
about the numbers of 2023.
Yeah.
And that was done, obviously, directly in response to the tort reform, right?
That's
so.
It.
That was that's not like the historical average.
Oh,
that's
okay.
not how
I definitely read this like we sue people more in Florida.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
But I guess that makes sense.
Correct, yeah. I mean listen, Florida does seem and does happen to be a pretty litigious place, you know,
mm-hmm.
When compared to a lot of places around the country. I wouldn't necessarily go to say that it's like just exponentially higher here than New York or any
okay.
other big city. But I would say that if you were going to affect the rights of consumers and injured parties in the state of Florida the way you just did in 2023, then yeah, you're going to create a massive influx of litigation
influx.
Into the court
and
system.
And what do you think, what kind of repercussions do you think this is going to have?
So, I mean, I think that the most obvious one, which I think is just a part of the plan, you know, of this big lobbying push, is to basically, you know, show the rest of the population in the state of Florida that are not perhaps injured, you know, that have not necessarily brought lawsuits, like, oh, look at us, nobody wants to do business here, you know, the insurance companies are going to get hurt, you know, all your premiums are going up because of all these frivolous, you know, lawsuits and all of these greedy trial lawyers, you know, and they're going to completely take the attention away from the fact that, you know, Governor DeSantis is the one that's responsible for creating this massive push. And, you know, there's going to be millions and millions and millions of dollars in lobbying efforts that's going to go towards trying to convince voters otherwise.
Do you think more of these cases will settle as a result of just having so many of them in the pipeline?
I think right now there's a lot to be determined. I mean, for a firm like us...
I know, I'm asking you to speculate.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think for a firm like us, there's a lot of opportunity in moments of crisis, and that's the sad truth, you know? Because, you know, we try cases, we've been doing that. And I think as a part of us, like even understanding our numbers and knowing, you know, the value proposition that we provide as a law firm, one of the things that actually had, as I get ready to enter 2024, we're just going over the numbers, and we're looking at some of the law firms that we do business with, and how long they would have the case on average, and how long we would have the case on average, what their highest offer was for a firm that does not litigate compared to a firm like us that does litigate, and what we would see on, say, a sample size of 50 cases. And what we found was of about approximately 50 cases, the average settlement value per case for that firm was around $9,000, right? Our firm, when we had that same case, and we put it in, that's based on their highest prior offer before we got the case.
Okay.
When we put that case into litigation and ultimately settled it, we settled it for an average of $97,000.
Wow.
Right? So that was the increase. The time that the prior firm would have the case was 18 months. The time that we would have the case would be about 6.5 to 7 months.
Okay.
And I think the total settlement, if you were to take all of those cases, you add them up in the total offer of settlements between the zeros that were offered and the actual numbers, it came out to be like $278,000. The settlements that we got on all of those cases was $2.8 million. And so you're able to see just the amount of value that you end up instilling in the cases for the cases to actually litigate, try cases,
right.
and provide that pressure.
Yeah, I think generally the public is more afraid of litigation as an overall.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, for the public and the businesses and the insurance companies,
right,
for sure.
People
yeah,
involved,
yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Not the lawyers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to be honest with you,
well,
lawyers too. Because
I live in litigation world,
yeah,
like you, so it doesn't.
Yeah,
much,
no,
but
no, but lawyers too. Because
sure.
to be honest with you, there's a certain type of panic that you see coming
sure.
from the other side when, you know, people call themselves trial lawyers, but they don't really like the pressure, and people do kind of crazy things. So what I see happening though is firms that try cases and litigate are going to benefit. The ones that don't are going to either leave the practice and go somewhere else, which, you know, is probably going to be a net benefit, you know, or they're going to work with other trial lawyers and trial firms that, you know, make this a big part of their practice.
Yeah,
so that they can, correct, exactly, exactly right. And so that's something I think is going to happen. You have a lot of attorneys that I know that are leaving the state of Florida and going to other, you know, states too.
Yeah.
And
here, Kentucky's a good place to go.
I don't know much about Kentucky, but
that
I mean, Kentucky's a beautiful place. I know that. I have
what?
Have you been?
She has, actually.
It's, yeah, so
then, oh my God, because we accidentally crossed from Cincinnati, Ohio, and found ourselves.
Have you been in a dark alley in Kentucky?
You have not been to Lexington.
No.
You have not been to Louisville.
You know, I try to stay away from crazy white people, Dylan. Right. I don't know.
You just want to stare on the crazy cute people.
Yes. I feel at home with the crazy cute ones. It is, but you know, we have a handle on this kind of crazy.
No, this is a sunny place for shaking.
I know, for sure.
No, you definitely should go to Lexington and Louisville. They're both beautiful towns. And you'll have a lot of
He's going to open a practice there. He has to start kissing us
now. On the next billboard in Kentucky.
But anyways, well, thank you so much, Dylan, for joining us today. And before we let you go, is any final thoughts for anyone listening or watching? Anything public needs to know?
Fuck the insurance company.
That's not exactly how I would phrase it.
He's like, I didn't say that.
No.
I'd say thank you
very much for having me on. You know, I really enjoyed myself. It was really nice coming in and sharing this time with you guys.
I see Dylan like lobbying, you know, like that's what I see Dylan doing in the future. Like,
I mean, listen, lobbying for consumer rights, you know, and for people that are injured 100%, exactly. You're a passionate guy, Dylan. I can be from time to time.
I'm saying that for real.
I appreciate that. We are very passionate. Our firm is here in Coral Gables in South Florida. We service all of Florida. The name of our firm is Cornish Hernandez Gonzalez. It's me, Igor Hernandez, my law partner, John Sullivan, Cam Cornish, and then we have two law associates, Dylan Boygris, who just came on. We're super excited to have him a part of the team, and Ira Combs, and then we have a staff of about 15, you know, others, paralegals and support staff that are helping us. You know, for us, every case that we have is very much a privilege for us to be able to kind of represent, you know, our community and just give back, because I think that although there aren't all clients that are very grateful for the work that you do, when you do have the people that are grateful, like it, you know, you're paid in spades, and it's just it's a blessing to be able to kind of be out there and helping people.
So it must be really rewarding work overall. I mean, it sounds like it is, right? You actually make a difference every day, which is really cool.
Yeah, I mean, we try to make a difference, you know, every day, and it is really rewarding. I mean, I think just being an attorney in general, you know, I think, and it's really easy to kind of lose sight of that, you know, whatever practice you're in, because it's pretty overwhelming with pressure. Sometimes you don't have the nicest clients. They're always calling. You've got family, real life.
The day-to-day.
Yeah, it's a privilege to be able to kind of represent people and just, you know, fight for the underdog against insurance companies and big business.
I love that, because I have that idealism in what I do. Not so much over there.
Well, I thought you said that you wanted to be a public defender back in the day, though.
If money didn't matter.
Because she said that you didn't care about the underdog. I said, but, you know, public defenders, that's all they do is fight for the underdog.
Yeah,
I mean, if you want to
that is a whole different conversation, my friend.
That Leslie's ideal job would be a
whole different conversation. And actually, it is not public defender. I wanted to do Fourth and Fifth Amendment.
It's not necessarily appeals.
And this comes from a whole other, like, dinner party question that she asks.
It's a conversation for another day.
Like hundreds of lawyers at a time. Like, what is their dream job if they didn't have to do what
they
were
doing? I always ask, okay, now you've talked about it.
Now we have to go here.
So I have a dinner party conversation I need to ask people. Maybe I've asked you, I don't remember.
Maybe we're asking him right now.
You should ask him.
Like,
right
that's
now.
It.
And the question was, in a world where money didn't matter, so all your needs were taken care of.
This is a commie state.
It is not a commie state.
You
always make my question.
The same amount of money no matter what you do.
It is not. It's your needs are taken care of.
Right.
So money is not an objective, it's not a consideration. Just take
right.
money out of the equation completely. Just forget it. It doesn't exist in this universe, right? So in a world where this doesn't exist, but you have to work, you have to have a job, and it doesn't have to be a 9-to-5, but you have to have a job. So, like, you know, sitting at home watching movies is not an option.
Right.
You must work.
Yeah, do something.
You
and the same
something.
Amount, more or less, like, it's not like one person works 3 hours a week and the other person works 40.
You know,
like, everybody works the same amount of time.
Everybody works, right?
Again, so, commie state. Commie state.
We're
people,
back to
like,
calling it a commie state.
Yeah.
But whatever. Let's, in this universe that does not exist, if you had to pick a profession, what would that profession be?
You know, it's not as sexy and
no, that's okay.
and exciting, but I'd probably do exactly what I'm doing.
Would you really?
Yeah, I really would, because I fell into it, but I'm very happy that I did. You know, at the time in which I went to law school, you know, I was an athlete my entire life. Mm-hmm. You know, I played sports from the time I was 4 until I was about 25, 26, and I did not know what I wanted to do. And my family weren't lawyers, doctors, and stuff like that. And so it was the height of the recession. I know I needed to go to grad school, whether it was business, medicine, whatever. Going to law school was like the most accessible thing for me at the time. And it also covered all the bases in terms of all these different industries that I could potentially work in, whether it was business, trial work as a public defender, personal injury, whatever. And so I went to law school as a safety, you know, to kind of like discover a little bit more about myself. And then when I was there, I actually met my law partner, Igor Hernandez, and, you know, had developed a bit of a bro crush. We'd be on trial team, in our second year of law school, arguing about fucking rules of evidence at 1:30 in the morning on a Saturday, you know, all of our weekends were consumed with prepping these fake cases to these competitions. And in conjunction with just like the legal satisfaction and just like understanding the law, the other side that I was a little bit of an artist, you know, when I was in high school and I enjoyed just creating things. And so the storytelling aspect of being a trial lawyer was like quenched, or really quenched that creative side of me. And so discovering the whole world of persuasion, how to persuade, how to tell stories, themes and theories and different things like that.
Triads.
Yeah, correct. All of that type of stuff. And
I love that.
And so
a whole podcast episode just on storytelling.
Oh yeah, it's incredible. And so like, and everything you do in life is a form of persuasion, you know, whether it's the news, you know, lobbying, trying cases and storytelling. We're all being persuaded in different ways. And so for me, it was incredibly impactful, for me to be able to do that and then also help people at the same time in the personal injury space or as a young public defender. The dream for us is to continue building and developing our practice, be able to be a little bit more selective, to work on less cases throughout the year and really choose those cases where we want to dedicate our time and sit down and mock try them and put together these incredible stories and, you know, bring it to, you know, in front of a jury, you know.
I love that. So you see, he'd be a lawyer. Yeah. So I will tell you that the results of my straw poll are...
And she's done this to like hundreds of people at this
almost
point.
Almost no lawyers say they want to be lawyers. I started this episode by saying he's a happy lawyer because he actually likes what he does.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of people say they want to go back and play a sport that they love to play. Sure. Yeah. A lot of people like... We have
Art
a
Ranger.
Friend, right?
Yeah.
They want to like sell their jam at the fair,
at the farmer's market,
every whatever.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Interesting, but it gets to the root of who you are and what makes you tick.
No,
right?
For sure. And I think that like one thing I would say, you know, and I don't have kids yet. I'm not married or anything like that. But if I'm blessed enough to have kids, I look forward to being able to share with them some of the experiences I had and some of the good and the, you know, the bad and some of the teaching moments. And one of the things for me, it would revolve around would be just like athletics. And because it was obviously a big part of my life for so long and shaped me into everything I really am today. But one of the reasons why I did not go back and I didn't really long to kind of, you know, want to continue playing ball, was because there was so much out there that I didn't feel that I was able to partake in, you know, whether it was traveling, you know, I was kind of a geek. I enjoyed geopolitics, international relations. I had an internship at a think tank in DC the year I got drafted and I never did that. Right. I couldn't go and study abroad when I was in college. And so there's a lot of sacrifice that you make there. But the reason I'm bringing that up is because I wanted to leave the game to go and do these other things. So I felt like I was living a meaningful life. Now, if I were to look back, because of I've been fortunate enough to kind of give back, whether at the public defender's office or at a personal injury practice and helping people, I feel that my body would be able to necessarily do it, and I'm too old for it, but mentally, I would be in a better place to be a more dedicated professional athlete, because when you're a professional athlete, you eat and sleep and drink it. You know, you're training during the season and the off season. Everything is in anticipation of what's coming, and you always have to make sure at the top of your game. And with anything that you're doing, whether it's sports or legal work, if you want to be at the top of your game, you have to be fully committed and all in.
Yeah.
And so at the time, I did not want to be, you know, completely committed. I have no regrets on how my career ended, you know, and I was very happy with the way I finished. And frankly, I was continuing to play well and I could have played. But I knew inside that's not where I was, you know. Now, because I have these other experiences, I would be better because I'd be more focused and more dedicated.
Well, it's just been years, right? You grow up.
Yeah.
After
no,
time.
For
change,
sure.
Evolve,
for sure.
I think is the word.
For sure. But the reason I'm bringing that up, though, is I think it just kind of speaks to the importance of people having all sorts of experiences. And sometimes, you know, the same way I kind of got tired of playing ball because there were other things out there I needed. You know, the attorneys that want to leave the practice of law to go start a podcast, you know, or maybe, you know, become an engineer or a pilot. You know, they may not have had these other diverse experiences leading up to the moments where they chose to what they're going to do for the rest of their life, you know?
I hear that.
So
just, I love that.
It's balance.
I think
balance.
That's a great closing thought. So yeah. With that, we're going to let you go, Dylan.
Thank
get back
you.
To work. Thank you so much for joining us. This has been Alina Santana and
Leslie Marenko
with Law Shit You Should Know, and see you again next week.
Yeah.